Hey everyone, Mike Nelson here. 372 pages, We'll Never Get Back is coming up in seconds. I just wanted to give an announcement that we will be doing a live show in Minneapolis on April 11th at Sisyphus Brewing. All the details, of course, will be on all of our pages and social media and all of that. And I just wanted to give a slight language warning to this episode. Ernest Cline says some naughty, naughty words at times, and we do quote Ernest Cline. We ourselves are like choir boys, but Ernest Cline, he does what he does. Anyway, enjoy the episode and hope to see you at our live show in Minneapolis on April 11th. Oh, friends, people out there listening, this is a very special episode. This is 372 pages, We'll Never Get Back. I am Michael J. Nelson, and on the other end of the line is Connor Listoka. Connor, how are you?
Friends, Romans, Gunters, lend me your rigs.
Those are stirring words. I'm glad you started off that way.
The classic Julius Caesar play by William Shakespeare.
Yeah, by who? Who's that?
Shakespeare, as many people did not know, was a famous playwright who was born in the town of Stratford-upon-Avon.
Oh.
On April 23rd, which many people also did not know, was the birthday of the classic 13th president, James Buchanan.
I did not know that.
Yep, that's why I know that. That's the trivia. That's what happens when you start talking and don't know where your sentence is going to end up.
Well, you climbed it up. I like when you make the reference that everyone knows and then a paragraph of explanation about the reference that everyone knows. That was perfect.
When the reference is Shakespeare, too, it really pays off by the time you get to that explanation.
Yes. And this is I would like to call this, I think it's fair to call this a very special episode because we have so much going on in this one. Of course, we have our regular departments. We have Dumb Sentence of the Week. We have Fanfic or Real. We have Boring Sentence of the Week. But we have a huge announcement as well.
Yep.
And we have a bit of a historical unearthing that I think will shock the world, but yeah,
absolutely. It's a big episode, and you know, despite the fact that it still shocks me to say this, not much is happening in the book by this point in time. There is a lot to talk about. Before we get to that, I have an interesting statistic for you. I looked it up this morning, and we, as of last week's episode, we have been talking about these books for 1,023 minutes. That is just like a touch over 17 hours. That is the collective. If you put all these episodes on back to back, that's where we would end up. I'm not sure if we'll make it to a full day of Cline discussion. We can't rock around the Cline. But this is still, I looked up, the Armada audiobook narrated by Will Wheaton is under 12 hours. So
wow.
You could listen to that, or you could add on 5 extra hours, you know, if you're taking a longer journey and listen to all of our talk.
My first reaction to you saying that was, of course, to laugh and be amused by it. But in my secret heart, I'm sitting in a room crying alone by myself. This is not a good use of one's life.
Right. Well, you know, if you look at the number of people downloading and multiply that by 17 hours, that's a lot of people.
Yes, join us.
Doing a lot of listening.
Yeah. Wow. Fantastic. Do you want to give the big announcement? Let's not bury this. Let's not bury the lead here. This is exciting stuff. This is why we're doing it. Let's all of us waste our time together, shall we?
Yes. We're going to do a live recording of this podcast to celebrate, to use an inappropriate word, the release of the Ready Player One movie, which comes out at the end of the month. But we're going to do a live podcast in Minneapolis, your hometown. And it's going to be on Wednesday, April 11th at Sisyphus Brewing, which is in the heart of downtown Minneapolis. And yeah, we're going to come out and we're going to have watched the movie 3, 4, 5 times by that point in time. And so we'll have...
Will we? Will we? I did not agree to this.
We're going to have a lot to talk about. And it's at a brewery. They've got a space where they do comedy events and such like that. So we'll do a full, you know, classic episode and talk about everything we have to bicker about, all the omissions from the movie. Are they going to, you know, is Pendergrass going to be in there? Are they going to have any flick syncs? Are we going to watch people pretend to be in another movie? There's, you know.
And if you're there, we can promise you there will be no lag. Your connection will be good. we'll have Wi-Fi right there. And no, it's a great location. It's a like a little separate room off a very nice, newish to me, brewery, right centrally located near the downtown area, very close to downtown. And we'll also be doing a doubleheader with my other podcast, Like Trees Walking, which is a podcast of about philosophy, religion, ooh, and the big issues of life. But it's an entertaining podcast. I wouldn't give you something that wasn't entertaining. So
it's completely the other end of the spectrum then from pop culture holy grails.
Yes. But I wanted
to co-hosted by the guy who had the rig implanted in his scrotum from
that is correct.
Yes. Okay. I'll be making an appearance.
And to be perfectly cliny about it, we call it Sisyphus Brewing because Sisyphus was a guy who rolled a rock. No, I'm not going to go into that because that's kind of what leads off my chapter. So
there has to be like a ship called the Sisyphus in like Alien 3 or something.
Right, exactly. All right, let's get into it. And all our departments are coming, we promise, but we got to get to the meat of this. And this was, despite being, like you say, sort of spinning the tires in the snow story-wise, I would say, a 4th of July fireworks in terms of his trying to stretch his character work and his prose. And that leads to good things, I think.
Yeah, yeah. It was a long chapter. And I think it's just important, as we discuss all this, to remember how the last chapter ended. We know that war is imminent, but he literally, the dun-dun-dun moment of the last chapter was his father saying, every second counts. So just, you know, as we keep talking about whatever happens here, that's looming over everything. So just keep that in mind.
Yeah. So up until this point, again, to just flesh this out, there's three guys on the moon. We'll meet those guys, but they're defending against a force of coming from Europa, the moon, an hostile force, and our hero has been recruited and goes up to the moon and meets his long-lost dad, who he assumed dead in a sewage treatment explosion, which I think we can all relate to. And he meets his dad, and that was kind of where we left it. His dad explained why he had to leave his family. And now we introduce the cast of characters that his dad has been living with for 19, well, not 19 years. How many?
Like, yeah, coming close to
17 years, something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, he died when he was one. So, yeah, 17 probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And, you know, but so these guys have been isolated up there. They've been taken away from their families. You know, there's been hints that there's maybe a little madness brewing, which is understandable because they're essentially in solitary confinement. I assume that none of them have had sex with anyone in the past 17 years. But so anyway, as you can expect from this sort of solitary confinement, they're just having a pretty good time up there, making some pop culture references, and we meet one of those immediately as they enter into the Moonbase Alpha Drone Operations Center.
Yep. Shall I read?
Yes, please.
I labeled this as the apple does not fall far from the tree, which you'll soon see why. Welcome, my father said. I pictured that like, welcome to Jurassic Park, of course. Welcome, my father said, stretching out his arms, to the Moonbase Alpha Drone Operations Center. We call it the Thunderdome. I would have closed paragraph there. No. Why? Well, because it has a dome, he said, pointing up, and we fight inside it, just like Mad Max. So that is why they called it.
And then he shrugged, and because Thunderdome sounds cooler than Drone Operations Center, which if you'll think back to when he introduced, when his comic book guy introduced the Crystal Palace, he asked him if it was because of the video game or something, and he shook his head and said, no, because it's easier to say than Earth Defense Alliance Strategic Command Post number 14, and it sounds cooler too. So, you know, even if that is a sort of joke, He used it 8 chapters ago.
But he's also the guy making up the other stuff. So, you know, I mean, in the military, they often do this. They're known for, of course, you just have anacronyms and you have, acronyms. I made up a word there.
An acronym, yeah. An They're acronyms. Old and inaccurate acronyms yes. that are not used anymore. Wow, hey.
Yeah, that's not bad. Hang on, we're going to pause this, and I'm going to go copyright, and Register. We're back. Yep. Yes, okay. Yeah, so there's the three guys on the moon, and then do you want to introduce the characters? I have a lot to say about each character, but I'll let you do the introduction. Introduce us to these fellas that his father, what's his,
Xavier Lightman, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. He probably was like talked out of that by every single lawyer at Random right. House or whatever. Yes. But yeah, I would introduce General Shin, but I don't have a gong, which I think
I can get the sound effect. I also run a morning zoo show, so I can do 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 do.
So he's, he's the same as every other Asian character we meet. He is I don't remember if it was General, whatever, Shin, but he meets him. He says, konnichiwa, and he bows, which is, just the way that all the guys were in Ready Player One and the way that the guy was on the bus with them anyway. I'm not sure. I guess he's including Asian characters for the sake of diversity, but he certainly, in his mind, knows what they all do every time that they introduce someone. But there's a little twist with this guy.
Oh, my goodness. Up his, yes, there
follows
is.
Up his bowing and his konnichiwa with the other stereotypical Asian phrase, which was, holy Toledo!
Exactly. That cracked me up. That was within a paragraph of meeting him, yeah. I think. I don't think we've established anything about him. There was no sentence like many of the, let's assume he's pulling from references from World War II or something. A lot of these guys, the generals in Japan, studied in the United States. And so we're very familiar with culture and all of this. Sure. He made no sentence like that. It was just like, here's right. a completely and utterly Japanese guy. And he says, holy Toledo within
seconds. I'm picturing... Wasn't the guy who was on UHF who ran Wheel of Fish, wasn't he in one of the shitty John Hughes movies?
Oh, yeah.
Wasn't he like an exchange student that said, like, automobile?
Long Duck Dong, I believe.
So I'm guessing like his Holy Toledo could be like the exchange student version. But
yes,
anyway,
exactly.
Maybe we're just projecting here. But maybe I am projecting. Anyway, so he meets Long Duck Dong, introduces himself to – well, so Long Duck Dong is saying Holy Toledo because he's making the looking back and forth between him and his dad, which is like the 18th time that he's hammering home that he looks like his dad. And he goes on to use all sorts of other – sort of heavy-handed things to really drive that point home. He says, like, it's hard to look at someone when they're wearing your face, that sort of thing. Like, but so if that's building to something, it certainly isn't doing a subtle job at it.
But I would like to add that I do that too when someone shows me their new baby, like a young married couple. I look at him, it's hard to look at him when he's wearing right. your face. They love that. They think that's
right.
great.
Because, you do. Sometimes you see a very young baby and you're like, oh, wow, it looks a lot like the parent. But you don't just like spit take and then like rush to the crib and like grab it with both hands and just stare at the baby because it's so incredible.
Well, you don't. I do that.
Yes. But yeah, and then other guy he meets is I was just picturing David Thewlis as this guy, sort of a tall British guy. I Graham was his name.
Please, Major Graham Fogg, 2 G's.
Yes.
Which immediately I know I've urged you to read, and I believe you've read a little.
Yeah.
Of P.G. Wodehouse.
Yeah, definitely.
Towering master of 20th century comedy, often played with British names. And it immediately put me in mind of, Gussie Finknoddle and Cat's Meat Potter Purbright, Major right. Graham Fogg. So my picture went a little back. I believe David Thewlis is a good starting place, too. But I thought of, there's a really old British actor named Terry Thomas, who was the... he was sort of the archetype of, he had a gap in his tooth and he was shocked by everything and dropping monocles and all of that. And I don't know what. So that's who I picture.
He looks sort of like the yes guy.
Yeah, exactly. That's what think of that. Only British it up, British right. the hell out of it, and you're good.
Or maybe Chris Finch. Yeah, I mean, it's how, he resisted the urge to say all these to not say what all these people look like from a specific character. That's baffling.
That yeah, he obviously has the specific movie in mind. Just tell us what it is. Right. You have not held back on anything else.
But yeah, so something that struck me here, I don't remember who this was, but I think it must have been Shin, says something, and then he laughed heartily at his own joke, and my father gave me an apologetic look, the same look I used to give to my mom when one of my friends came over and broke something. And I was so this is an immediate reference. I was just wondering how often this happened, like if he's pinpointed, he has a specific look to do when he gives his mom, when his friends come over and break something. He just this
either had very cousin. Clumsy friends, or there was one moment and it was very memorable.
Right, you have to imagine his friends are just, you know, carrying something and then distracted by his mom's, you know, gorgeous looks, that they're just dropping the dinner plate they're carrying or walking into the door frame.
That's probably what it was. It was, again, the eyes popping out and
his mom's tongue rolling out. She's washing the car in the driveway and they're dropping their rig on the ground. But yeah, so then they every second counts. They go into the like hall or whatever of this Thunderdome, where there's a long folding wooden table and three folding metal chairs arranged against the far wall. The table's surface was covered with a variety of Dungeons & Dragons rule books, gaming screens, and dozens of oddly shaped dice. Are you laughing because there's no RPG supplements? Because that's what I am furious about.
Oh, this is incredible.
It's like, where there's smoke, there's fire. But he left out the RPG supplements after two books of building up them.
Yep, and this is what he says. This is Major Graham. So we have two majors, I believe, Major Shin, Major Graham, and a general in his father. And Major Graham says in his British accent, "We play D&D 4 or 5 nights a week," Graham explained when he saw me eyeing the setup. "Helps to pass the time. Shin is usually our dungeon master." He smiled at me. "My character is 27th level Elven Archer." So the scene is set. So these guys who are on the vanguard of protecting Earth from these invaders, I mean, and they talk about the constant threat, the depression. I've pictured like World War One. I've read a lot about World War One. The shelling would get so intense and so long that their blood pressure would lower and their eyes would just dilate and they couldn't move just from the stress of it. And so then
literal shell shock.
Yeah, it was a shell shock they'd never experienced before. Obviously, these are all modern. And so the first waves of the rifle soldiers would come in and just see these guys just sitting there, just staring at them. And that's what I picture. I mean, these guys are under enormous stress, but still they have time to play D&D 4 or 5 nights a week.
Shin's the DM, so he's like taking time on his own to sort of draw up these maps and plan out where the treasure is going to be and, like, you know, where the dragon is going to be in the dungeon. It's that's how it works. They indicate later they have these yearly attacks pretty much almost to the day. And then, like, they're always so decimated that they have to, like, restock all these things. But, you know, in the meantime, let's roll some 20 Ds.
Yeah. And, at first I was prepared to think this was the most ridiculous thing I ever heard. But this it set off something in my mind. And I looked into it. I was thinking, you know, so they're like an isolated outpost with a dark and evil and unknown force, a gathering storm, if you will, as they as they await this imminent attack and the threat to everything they hold dear. And so, you know, why not pass the time with this, I guess, on some level. And as I looked into it, it did spur something in my mind. And it's interesting, Churchill was under the same stress, of course, at
19 Winston Churchill
1937, 1938, as the forces of Nazism started to gather in the East. And you know what, I went back to that famous speech of his, and he references Dungeons and Dragons. Now, I could not believe this, so I pulled it up, and I want to play it now to prove to you all that
must have missed it.
No, it's true. It's shocking. I always misheard it. You know, it's like the play it again, Sam. It's misheard.
He never, right, exactly.
He never actually says that. So let's roll the actual speech from Winston Churchill.
Even though large tracts of Europe and many old and famous states have fallen or may fall into the grip of the Gestapo and all the odious apparatus of Nazi rule, we shall not flag or fail. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight Flumpf. We shall fight Rakshasa on the material plane. We shall fight the Rust Monster with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall not fail a saving throw, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight Githyanki. We shall fight the Owlbear. We shall fight the Gelatinous Cube. We shall fight in Chasenta. We shall fight in Zavara. We shall never surrender.
Yeah, so there you go.
Yeah. It is subtle, but...
Yeah, but now you notice that once you hear it, you can't... Yeah, you notice the difference. For
sure. I'm looking forward to the deleted scene on the Darkest Hour Blu-ray where Gary Oldman and the Gelatinous Cube sit down for some... For some peace, dogs.
Exactly. All right. So they're on the moon. They're playing D&D, and
well, they're not just playing D&D. They pass the time in other ways because he notices they've got a hell of a drum kit set up.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yes.
And so they pause to talk about that, and as imminent war approaches, and every second counts, they talk about the name of their band, which is the Bishop of Battle. He immediately, of course, recognizes that reference as the Emilio Estevez segment from the Nightmares Horror Anthology. And as they, prepare to fight for the existence of the Earth, they all just are delighted that he recognizes this reference as goofy grins spread across each of their faces.
I said in my notes, I of course have pulled out that entire thing, said, oh God, will please some talented artist out there give us a rendering of the general and the two majors defending Earth from annihilation with their goofy grins on their face after hearing that someone recognized the name of their tribute band.
Yes. There's a moment on The Simpsons that's sort of become more popular in the past year in like the memes they make where they're playing a board game and Bart gets the dud in the mystery date game. There's a scene of Homer like with this really sort of weird animation of this grin spreading to his face. And so that's what I'm imagining as the goofy grin. Yeah. But they grin at this reference getting, and then a few sentences later, they were all still beaming at me for getting their band name, which is, it's like,
General, please, we are fighting for our very existence.
Right.
Stop grinning at me.
What? And I was thinking, I was like, so if I'm ever hanging out with like, someone I've just met or even a good friend, like, and I'm like, let's say we were at a farm and like there was like two different looking mules and someone was like, hey, like those are two mule variations. I'd be like, oh yeah, like, that's a great Tom Waits album. I probably wouldn't even say that. I would just be like, nice. The idea of like a goofy grin spreading onto my face at like someone referencing something that I know and then beaming at them is so hard to imagine.
Yeah, he does this a bunch. It's obvious that he wants to be rewarded for every reference that he makes in real life, and he's transferring it to fiction.
Maybe like an hour later, if we were like getting, beers, it'd be like, oh yeah. So like, by the way, what's your favorite song off that album? And we could talk about it the way that actual people would do instead of just being like, got it. Here's a reference. Got it.
Right.
But yeah, so this is the start of, we talked about this last week, on the plane where like people were like up and down the entire time, the Milo weed smoker guy the pretty religious mom. They were like just back and forth at their mood swings. But this one is the start of his dad's insane mood swing.
So this guy is, he's off the charts.
I tracked it. There's like six steps of it. So he's got a goofy grin spreading across his face and he's beaming at his son for getting the band name. Five sentences later, I glanced back over my father. Keep track of that phrase, folks. I glanced back over at my father, but he was staring at his feet and shaking his head in embarrassment. Half a page later, my father frowned at me and seemed about to say something. So they've gone from pride to embarrassment to sort of like anger. Less than a page later from that, to my surprise, my father grinned at my remark. That remark, you might ask? The remark was, at least we get to have our favorite snacks. Bonus. So that triggers a grin. And several readers, listeners wrote in that grinning and laughing happened a lot in this section, you know, as the war approaches. After later on that page, after his father grins, my father seemed genuinely embarrassed by this praise. And the praise is just, you're the top fighter on Earth. And so that triggers genuine embarrassment. Like, and then half a page after that, my father exchanged a strange smile with his two friends, then nodded at Debbie. So his father is just whipping back and forth between.
But he's
anger.
Also, he must be like a clinical therapist level of empath or something, like just observing everybody's just the barest emotions that they're giving out on their face. He's able to dive deep and see what they're really feeling. And, you know, my father looked at his shoes in genuine embarrassment. He was actually, you know, stomping out a cigarette or whatever.
Right. Yes. His father's just like, oh, this shit again. Like, you know, I'm good at this game. Like, I've been good at it for 17 years. Please stop talking about it. Like,
as a general, I really shouldn't even be fraternizing with any of these people. I've got to get out of this room as soon as I can.
I was just imagining someone like approaching Chuck Yeager and being like, man, when you broke the sound barrier, and he's just, you know, blushing and genuine embarrassment. Yes. Is like, listen, like, please, like, I have a certain constitution that allowed me to get to this point.
Yes, I'm a highly competent individual. Now, you didn't mention what the, or maybe you had pulled this out too, but I'll bring it up now. The what's the band name again?
It was the Bishop of Battle.
Okay, and so he asks about this, or he's curious about this, and totally British guy, Graham Eaton Hogg or whatever, says, we can play some pretty decent Van Halen covers, Graham continued. Maybe we'll jam for you guys later. Sure, I said uncertainly. That would be cool. So this is like a totally British guy in totally, this is modern day, right?
Yes.
On the moon base. Is trying to impress the 18-year-old kid by saying we can play some pretty cool Van Halen covers.
Right. And, like, you know, it's one of those things that you see, like, my friend sent me one yesterday that was like the Michigan Fab Five and the Christian Laettner shot happened as close to now as they did the Lou Alcindor UCLA title run, you know, just to indicate how ancient these things seem. And so, like, the idea that this, 17-year-old kid is going to be impressed by Van Halen at this point in time.
You guys are sitting on the moon playing D&D and doing Van Halen covers.
Right.
My God, Earth is doomed. We are doomed.
Yes. And Van Halen from here to now, from now to then, is probably like Van Halen to, you know, Elvis on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Yes.
Like, it's, anyway. But then right after that line, he says, maybe Shin or the dad says, we're not going to play Van Halen covers. Aliens are invading in a few hours, remember? And which is a line that reminded me of, this is not a movie that we've ever really watched or done, but we watched it one time in the office, the Mortal Kombat movie. And it's not very good, obviously. But at the end, there's a line that I thought was just the funniest thing I had ever heard. A sort of demon appears to talk to one of the main characters, and he assumes the form of his dead brother. And the line to his brother was, remember when our parents died?
Yeah, that's right.
And it was just like, now that you mention it, like, yeah, that's a that is something that is a prominent part of my growing up experience. But yeah, aliens are invading in a few hours. Remember? Oh yeah, yes, right.
Scratch, let's save the world. Scratch the head and wait. What alien? Oh, you mean the? Oh, that's right. The aliens that are our prime.
The reason we're on the moon.
The reason we dug a tunnel 50 stories under the moon. That's right. That's right. Yes. Yep. Got it now. Sorry, little brain fart there. Yeah. Forgot.
But yeah. So then they reveal, as we just said, obtained all their favorite snacks. This was just sort of, if you're on the fence at all about whether you should have any sympathy for any of these idiot gamers, this just throws it all out the window, I think, because again, they've every second counts, but he is pointing out the dozens of boxes of his favorite breakfast cereal, Lucky Charms.
Oh, the recruits. Yes, yeah. It's breakfast cereal, but it's referred to in a way that really kicks it off nicely.
Okay.
Care for some snackage, Lieutenant? He asked. Your favorite.
Wait, who asked that?
This is the general. This is Patton coming to a base after he slaps the guy for being a coward and having the shell shock. Says tenderly to one of the other people, this is Patton, care for some snackage, Lieutenant? He asked. Your favorite snacks were listed in each of your EDA profiles, so we stocked up on all of them. You're a Lucky Charms man, right? Dry with no milk? We laid in a few dozen boxes for you, see? So that, I just wrote, like, okay, we get that your maturity was stunted. Like, we know that that's the whole book. Why do you have to point it out? And I'm a child, is what he's really saying.
Right. I mean, you know, I'm looking at this list now, and like I said, I had nothing but contempt for this scene. I've probably eaten 75% of these things in the past year, which, you know,
did
whatever.
Did you lay in a bunch of them, though? Did you have the military come in and lay in a bunch of them?
Right. The guy who was, you know, taking a break, who had enlisted in the EDA to, you know, help save the world because he saw the, you know, you're in the army now ad, who was tasked with just like going into 7-Eleven and buying these things, had to have been like, well, this is not what I signed up for. But so they lay out all those snacks for everybody. And then, you know, they're like, how did you get this data? They're like, the EDA knows everything about everyone, kid. Your pulse rate, blood pressure, sweat content. And so I just imagined Milo, the stoner comic book guy, just sort of being like, everything? You've been really monitoring everything, because there's some stuff I do pretty regularly that I don't want anyone to know about. And
oh, we know that too. The general laughed. You know,
he slides him a bottle of Jergens across the table.
I have the list. Do you want to? Do you have the list of the foods?
List of snacks.
Yeah, that he laid in. Yeah.
So there's stacks of nacho cheese combos and Slim Jims scattered around Milo's pod, along with a small mountain of Diet Mountain Dew, bags of cheddar jalapeno Cheetos, and a row of 2-liter bottles of Hawaiian Punch laid out for Wody. Bags of multicolored Skittles for Debbie, not the monochromatic Skittles that many people enjoy. And besides Chen's pod, dozens of silver energy drink cans with Ki Li printed on the side, surrounded by writing in Chinese.
Yep. This, I recall.
Our best and brightest.
Yeah. Well, remember in the in Henry V, before the Battle of Agincourt, he did lay out those a big pile of snacks and talks about that for each one of them.
Oh, I was sipping soda again, and that spit taked, and that burned. Oh, my God.
But just, I mean, imagine any book where just a list of snacks, and this is acceptable to anyone? I can read a, you know, I can go to the store. It's like walking down a 7-Eleven aisle and just describing stuff. There's nothing about it.
That people, you know, that people out there are like, I'm going to play video games tonight, so I need to obtain Mountain Dew. You know, I guess that's a marketing triumph, but I guess it's a way that some people behave.
Well, luckily for me, Kushmaster came in and broke up the dark clouds that hung over me after that snack display were, he broke it up with his humor. He says, yeah, thanks, General. Milo said, finally recovering from his stroke of paralysis. I mean, holy shit, that's a huge compliment coming from Red Jive himself. You're the best of the best of the best, sir. I've been studying your moves for years. We all have. So the stoned guy suddenly wakes up. It seems like it's something from a dumb comedy of the 80s or something. Like, he shakes his head around.
Right.
Oh, hey, thanks, General. Right. And then everyone, like, there's a couple of minutes of, like, takes from people looking at him, and then he falls back asleep.
Right, yes. Or he takes the sip of Mountain Dew and, like, the Popeye music plays, and that's what gets him going.
Yeah.
The other guys introduced themselves. I thought that this was funny. Shin uses the handle Max Genius. And Graham says, my call sign is With Nailed, Graham finished, though these two rarely use it. We prefer to call him Limes instead, Shin said. It's short for Limey. He hates it. Graham nodded. Indeed, I do. We all smiled in recognition at their familiar call signs. So I was like, did you wait until they finished their idiotic banter before you all smiled? Like, did you... Did you just forget to move that sentence up after you added the idiotic banter? Like, it's goofy grins, I assumed, broke out.
Yes, of course. But he has trouble stacking up his goof. It's like it's an airport with planes coming in and coming out. Goofy grins. It's very tough to keep them all. Major embarrassment, genuine embarrassment.
Yes, genuine.
Is always on the runway, too. So it's really tough.
Yeah, I mean, genuine embarrassment is like, I don't remember when the last time that you would feel something like that, but it's a rare feeling. Like, it doesn't happen to most people. And like, your face flushes, you feel like it's a very unpleasant feeling, and it doesn't happen very often. So,
I mean, I've often thought, everyone is, when you're awake at night or something, you had too much coffee, and your mind will go to a genuine embarrassment in your life. And there's times it's been like 35 years before where I'm just oh God, why did I say that? And I've often thought, think about the fact that if you're going to live another, however many years, you're going to have like 10 or 15 moments of those again. Like, I think about those in the future. Like, it's awful. But this just happens. This just happens in the middle of describing snacks for this guy.
Yes, exactly. They didn't have the flaming hot jalapeno cheddars. I'm so embarrassed.
I'm genuinely, genuinely embarrassed. This was a sentence that just confused me. I think you'll understand when I read it. My father waved his hand at the view screen covering the domed ceiling. What is the? Oh, Thunderdome. Yes. please state everything as a reference, or I don't even know what you're talking about anymore.
This is another good one. Just because, like we said, these are he's stretching his ability to describe the way that people interact with each other. And not only are the characters paper thin, but the sort of stage directions are also very amateurish, as they just described after the we recognized their call signs. But this one I thought was particularly good. They're talking about how they managed to defeat Driller or the Decahedron or but they Shin and Graham are saying, so they say, "How did you manage to take it down?" I asked. Shin and Graham both grinned again, as if they've been waiting for this question. "It takes two to make a thing go right," Shin recited, smiling cryptically. Graham nodded, then added, "It takes two to make it out of sight." They looked as if they were about to recite more of the song's lyrics, but my father shook his head slightly and they both fell silent. So they were. Because I was curious what they were going to do, because that's the chorus of the popular 80s party rap song by Rob Bass and DJ Easy Rock. But that "It Takes Two" is what they're going for. But then were they about to launch into "I Want to Rock Right Now"? "I'm Rob Bass and I Came to Get Down"?
Yeah.
Were they going to keep going to "I'm Not Internationally Known But I'm Known to Rock the Microphone"?
Well, clearly,
because I get stupid. I mean, outrageous. Stay away from me if you're contagious. Like, it would have added nothing to their performance. And the point was made.
Well, that's why the firm hand of, think General Patton shaking his head and, waving a finger at them like, "Gentlemen, please. Right. This is the war room. This is neither the time nor the place to continue to recite this. You recited it the perfect amount."
Right. And then the "It Takes Two to Make Things Go Right" triggers the cryptic smile, just in case, where is he going with this? Very familiar line.
So they watch the film of, like, football films. And in fact, if the reference wasn't clear enough, they watch this film of him defeating the dodecahedron or whatever, right? The mech my father was in reached Vance's mech, ripped its escape pod free with Vance inside, and tucked it under his arm like a football. So clearly just a reference to the Monday Night Football robot animations, I assume.
Yeah, I guess.
Does he know sports ball?
It seems like he's probably like triggering some clenched teeth during this scene.
I would think that would irritate everyone. So then they watch it. It's him. He does some rescue that I couldn't, again.
It was very hard.
Physical descriptions are very tough for him. But he says here, so the whole crowd is this team that's going to save the Earth is watching it. And it says, "The footage became more impressive and more unsettling to watch with each viewing." And now the first time they all applauded, even hardened majors, everyone. So what did they do as it became even more impressive?
Like, right. Well, they got the feeling that He got the feeling they watched it on a regular basis and they applauded like this every time.
Yeah, I just mean, how did it get more? Were they like, then they were throwing ticker tape parades? You know, it was like the French when Lindbergh landed, they were going insane. Like, you've seen it seven times in a row.
He's like, this one should dub Carmina Burana over it. So, like, that gets even more intense. Right. But, yeah, so I guess they keep applauding. But, yeah, he also said it was a nearly impossible shot, like a three-pointer from full court with 1 second on the clock, which is, again, like, for all the other references, this has to be the one that people are, like, you know, going to Wikipedia to be like, three-pointer for full court? What?
And then being very disappointed when they see the answer. Yeah. Sports ball.
Yeah. But, yeah, so that's how they destroyed the disruptor, also known as the decahedron, also known as the Black Betty, also known as the Tensider.
Black Betty, by the way, is explained, of course.
Yes, of course.
It does. It's not just left there.
Listening to as he did it. And this is another, just again, this is a, you know, I'm not proud of this, but I needed to look at the text in order to make some of these control Fs and stuff. And in the original version of this manuscript, the decahedron was, and every time it's mentioned, a dodecahedron. So that changed at some point in time. It went from 12 sides to 10. And
what? Why?
A complete lateral move, I suppose. But I'm not sure if I thought that the dodecahedron was a 20-sided dice. And I guess maybe he did too. But it's a 10-sided dice. So dodecahedron, not worth printing in a New York Times bestseller. Decahedron is what pushed it over the top, I guess, from his editor's point of view.
Well, his editor did something anyway. We're always yelling at our fictional editor, so yes. He did something there. It did tighten things up quite a bit,
right? But yeah, so then the chapter is reaching its end, and he says that they're all going in to go stuff their faces for their last meal. But he says, if I was about to die, I wanted the breakfast my mother made for me that morning to be my last meal, not some Salisbury steak dinner reheated in a moon-based microwave. I was like, well, that's kind of sweet. But then I was like, wait a second. Like, the meal your mother made for you was meatloaf. It's like another cafeteria staple.
Yeah,
like,
it's basically the same thing as Salisbury.
Yes, exactly. It's reformed. It just has that. So I thought that was a funny, just sort of like, really? She didn't, you know, whatever. Not worth analyzing.
This was a good moment because this is at the chapter's end that you're referencing there. And I had this note that he, so they're talking about all this stuff. They just watched the thing. They realized the odds are stacked well against him. And Shin says, but that's why we have to make sure we do survive, because then we finally may get our chance to end this war once and for all. I waited for Graham or my father to agree with Shin, but both of them were silent. Anyone hungry? My father asked, which I had hoped that would be like the perfect Klein ending. And I thought, like, oh, man, now there's words after it. But then I wasn't disappointed because the chapter closer is probably, Graham replied, giving me a grim smile as he quickened his pace towards the exit. That's why I, for one, intend to stuff my face. So he pulled the fat out of the fire. I thought he was really going to blow it there with a chance to.
Right.
But the chapter ends as they're about to be annihilated by a British guy talking about how he's going to stuff bangers and mash into his maw.
That was not an accident that I used that, because I think they used that during the start of the next chapter to describe what everyone's doing. And I think that's how he described eating his meatloaf, too. His mom was gazing at him with parental love as he was stuffing his face. So,
yep.
Well done, sir. But that's the next chapter.
Yes. Chapter 17. Meantime,
we have, I think, our most popular feature, one that has proven increasingly difficult and increasingly funny, and that is real or fanfic. And now I bet they bitching because my flow switching, trying to tell me what to write about some fanfiction.
Can't they just be happy? I no longer have to face eviction that I'm living out my life. I'm living. Oh, yes. This is good stuff. I know that you sent me a somewhat cryptic. We keep our selections close to the vest, mm-hmm. as we do truly want to fool each other. But you let tip your hand a little bit that you had some special stuff for us, and I'm not afraid to say I do too. So I'm excited.
Oh, boy.
Real or fanfic? This is where we test one another. We give samples that are either fanfic written by listeners. Now we have to do written by listeners rather than selected randomly from the web or from an upcoming chapter. And of course, as we close into the end of the book, it becomes more difficult. And it also becomes more difficult as people get craftier at writing in the Kleinian style. So that's where we are. And this is real or fanfic. What do you got for me?
All right. So I have there. Some of them are shorter, but I have five today.
Whoa. All right.
Yeah. Right, so here's number one. "That's a crazy idea," Mom said as more missiles exploded nearby. "But it might just be crazy enough to work. Still, if we're going to live long enough to flip the self-destruct switch, we're really going to have to get smart about our next steps." "Then I better whip out my shoe phone," I said.
Wow. Oh, that is craftier. Learning. They're learning every time.
All right. All right. Number two. "I unlocked the store and let everyone inside. When my father saw the store shelves lined with high-end Armada and Terra Firma flight controllers, he broke into a broad smile. 'This is perfect,' he said as he began to grab items off the shelves and hand them to each of us. 'I need each of you to build the best rig you can as fast as you can.'"
Man, okay. That's a different take on it, but I like it equally.
Right. Here's the third one. "I realized that I had already taken four steps up the shuttle's ramp before I stopped to turn around and face my mom. 'I love you,' she said. 'I know,' I answered, mimicking Harrison Ford's classic ad-lib from The Empire Strikes Back. My dad was standing behind her like Chewbacca with his protective hand on her shoulder."
Okay.
And number four. "I knew it," my father said. "President Nixon ordered NASA to strap a nuke onto that probe, didn't he?" Everyone but Hawking nodded grimly.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And then here's the last one. What? How many do I have? Well, anyway, I have two more, actually. "Watching the ship burn, I began singing the lyrics to Bruce Springsteen's 1984 hit single, Dancing in the Dark, to myself. 'Can't start a fire without a spark. This gun's for hire, even if we're just dancing in the dark.' 'Nice shot, boss,' I heard my father say over the communication system, referencing one of Springsteen's well-known nicknames. 'Damn,' I thought, embarrassed. I hadn't realized I was singing out loud."
Oh, my God.
And here's the last one. "I felt my brain go numb trying to process what my dad had just told me. I had learned the truth. Armada was real. I had learned the truth behind the truth. We were being invaded by Nazi spacemen from Europa. Now Dad had told me the truth behind the truth behind the truth. There was no Europans. The invaders came from Alaska. The whole war was an elaborate scheme to convince geeks and gamers that they could accomplish something more than staring at a screen all day, as if Willy Wonka had been a government agent whose secret mission was to give candy factories to kids who didn't suck. And it had failed horribly."
Oh, my God.
All right. I hope you're taking notes. That got a little...
I think I have the mentally ticked off in my mind. But go okay. Rundown for listeners.
So there was the, we're going to have to get smart about our next steps. Then I better whip out my shoe phone.
Yep.
There was breaking into the store. "I need each of you to build the best rig you can as fast as you can."
Mm-hmm.
"I love you, I know," mimicking Harrison Ford's classic ad-lib from The Empire Strikes Back.
Mm-hmm.
"President Nixon ordered NASA to strap a nuke onto that probe." Everyone but Hawking nodded grimly. There was "Dancing in the Dark," "Nice shot, boss," I heard my father say, referencing one of Springsteen's well-known nicknames. And then "Truth behind the truth, behind the truth. The whole war was an elaborate scheme, as if Willy Wonka had been a government agent."
Okay. I am normally wrong at these things. I don't think we have never been over, I don't think, roughly 50%.
Yeah, we've had it has been a tricky thing to do.
But just to be clear, these could all be real. They could all be fanfic. They could be any mixture thereof. And
I am
going to say that all but the final one are fanfic. The most ridiculous one at the end, I think, is real.
Willy Wonka, truth behind the truth behind the truth.
Yeah.
Colossally wrong. That one is fanfic written by Theodore. The shoe phone was fanfic written by Jerry, J-E-R-E, I think. Real was his father saying you need to build the best rig you can as fast as you can. Fanfic was Harrison Ford's classic ad lib. This is the one that I wrote last night. I almost cried. Janelle sent this one in, and Lauren fell to the ground when I read it to her. I just want to read it again. "I knew it," my father said. "President Nixon ordered NASA to strap a nuke onto that probe, didn't he?" Everyone but Hawking nodded grimly. And that is real.
Oh, no.
That sounds like, you know, Axe Cop. And I don't know why Hawking's not nodding grimly, but it's a very funny thing to imagine. Mackie wrote Bruce Springsteen's Dancing in the Dark. That was fanfic. And then Theodore wrote Willy Wonka.
Oh, all right. Well, it's now impossible. I give up on the game, actually. I mean, it's fun. It's fun to play, but I give up. I throw in the towel.
Blindfolded dart.
Yep. All right. Here are yours. I only have three, but they're not really long, but they're slightly longer. There's a number one. He also hijacked all of their external speakers and then used them to play a song I recognized immediately from his old Raid the Arcade mix, Run's House by Run DMC. Archie really hates hip hop, we heard him say. I bet this will throw him off balance like Ride of the Valkyries. That's number one. Number two. And there were no MP3s or file sharing. If you wanted to steal music, you had to go down to the record store and shoplift it yourself. Or you had to wait around all day and tape it off the radio. And then the DJ would talk over the beginning and fuck it all up. You want to hear about hardship? You couldn't just download porn. You had to bribe some homeless dude to buy you a copy of Hustler from the 7-Eleven. It was either or jack off to the lingerie section of the JCPenney catalog.
is that Milo talking? I don't know. All right.
That's my sample. All right. Here's number three. I was showing Milo some of the things we grow in our hydroponic garden. And now you're getting stoned out of your gourds, I said, while listening to Dark Side of the Moon on the Far Side of the Moon. This is a special strain of Yoda Kush that I myself created, Shin said, holding up his giant spliff. Milo said, "This ganja is part of the war effort. I love it." He broke into song, and Shin immediately joined him. "America, fuck yeah, coming to save the motherfucking day, yeah." So that's one, two, and three. Number one was Run DMC, Raid the Arcade Mix. File sharing and having to get a homeless guy to buy you pornography.
Yeah.
And number three was Kush, Yoda Kush.
Yoda Kush, I mean, it's a great detail, but I think I feel like the Team America at the end was a bridge too far. So I'm guessing that's fanfic. I bet that JCPenney catalog, I just don't. How would that fit into the last 100 pages of the story? I think that's fanfic. I think the first one with the stodgy one-eyed captain hating Run DMC like the guy in the Twisted Sister video, I think that's the real one.
Oh, my friend. I have pulled a Pendergast on you, or you have. I don't know how that phrase actually works. These are all three the writings of Ernest Cline. However... I pulled a slight trick on you. Number one is from a different work of his nonfiction work.
Wait,
The World According to Ernest. So I cheated, but you can see the end there. That is from his autobiographical, The World According to Ernest, or The Importance of Being Ernest, or I don't know, whatever.
Is it a short story that takes place in this universe?
No, I pulled it from something else.
Okay.
But it's his writing.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's all his writing. I just wanted to turn things on its head today. So
you had to get a guy to buy you Hustler or jack off to the JCPenney catalog.
Yeah, this is him speaking. This is his voice. It was
Yoda.
Yeah, and the Yoda Kush is coming right up.
Oh, okay. So the Hustler one was him. Okay.
There's only one that they're all his writings. The second and third are from the book. The first one I just took from something else, just to throw you off off the scent.
You two are getting stoned out of your gourds.
Yes. So yeah, the Run DMC, that's coming right up. That's not far, I think. The Kush thing is a major point, I think, of the battle that they go into to save the Earth. Is Milo gets stoned with Shin with their Yoda Kush. So that's all real. And then they sing the America.
Team America fight song.
Team America thing, yeah. So that's all real.
All right. Yeah. Well, there you go. I look forward to it. I'm stunned.
So I don't know what we'll do. Next week is going to get tough.
Yeah, it's going to be tricky.
Yeah, since I'm already pulling these carnival tricks now, who knows what will happen next.
All right. Well done, everyone.
Yes, very good. It fooled me.
So yeah, the next chapter begins with a bang. Just to reiterate, the war is imminent and every second counts.
Yes.
And as they...
So they're rushing to battle stations. They are...
stuffing their faces.
Klaxons are going off. They are jumping into ships. Shots are firing everywhere. This is like Okinawa. They're under... Right? No?
Yeah, somehow the walls have sprung a leak like they're on a submarine, even though they're on the moon.
Yes, it's Dust Boot as they're plunging to the depths of the Mariana Trench.
Nope, they're eating Salisbury steak sitting around the table. And believe it or not, Graham sits next to Debbie. And only then did I realize that their body language from the two of them were crushing on each other in a big way.
Behind the scenes peek, I was ahead of Connor for the first time, I believe, reading the material for this podcast, and I made him guess who would be crushing on each other immediately. I mean, this is immediate. They walked in, they went to a briefing together, they cheered together over the footage that, I mean, Major Graham Fogg has seen hundreds and hundreds of times, and applauds each and every time. But gets more excited as it goes on. But anyway, that briefing, really, in your mind, time-wise, how long did that last?
An hour? I mean...
Yeah, tops, right?
Yeah.
They showed the thing, they talked briefly, and then they said, anyone hungry? And they went in, and then this meal was laid out. And immediately, Graham sits next to Debbie, and they start crushing on each other. So.
Sparks fly, yeah. I mean, you know, before this point, Debbie had been like, I hope that my, you know, three young boys are... you know, gonna survive this. I hope that they don't think ill of me for leaving them without getting in touch. You know, I can only imagine her heart is just torn to pieces just by the idea that she might never see them again. But then she sits down for some mashed potatoes and is like, well, David Thewlis here is, a tall drink of water.
Yep. And here's a detail that I noted right from the start of the chapter. He walks in and he sees the meal laid out and he says, he identifies that it's all laid out with a table with fine bone china. So he is able to identify fine bone china at first sight, which is, it's really impressive for a guy who spends 50 hours out of every day by his math staring at some sort of screen and watching, you know, the Brady Bunch over and over or whatever the hell he's doing. But that's impressive.
Yeah, I feel like I've only ever even like heard the term fine bone china in like if a cartoon is setting it up to be knocked over by Garfield or something. But like, I guess he's developed a keen eye for maybe antiques appraising shows that he watches with his mom in between back-to-back viewings of Say Anything.
Yep. So very impressive. And then they tuck into this meal. So again, threat is imminent, but let's go.
Yeah. But yeah, so they're crushing on each other. Shin and Wody are crushing on each other too, which I think has been firmly established is an inappropriate relationship. I guess you're out of international waters on the moon, but I think she's 16, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
So just to be clear. So Corporal Shin notices all this stuff and says to Milo and Wade, Zach, in a conspiratorial turn, set course for romance, Shin quoted, doing such a perfect Patrick Stewart impersonation that Milo and I both laughed out loud.
Mm-hmm.
Continuing the 100% track record of everyone in this book never having laughed at something that was actually funny.
What I noted about that was that there is an ellipses there, so it is set course, and so they must have all sort of tensed up and their eyes widened with goofy grins. For what? For romance. Oh man, that was, I think that came up in a fanfic or reel in the past, as I recall, because I could not believe that. This was a great sentence in the middle of that. People all over the world, they're talking about the panic that would ensue if they again, they're just moving from place to place, sort of killing time with the talk of, you know, instead of doing stuff, They're telling, not doing, like repeatedly. But they explain, people all over the world saw those EDA shuttles with their own eyes this morning when the shuttles were flying around to pick up essential recruits. So people saw the shuttles when the shuttles were flying around. That is the best time to see the shuttles, you know, if you think about it.
I saw the sunset last night as the sun was setting.
Yes. Oh, great client.
But this is another good one, sort of with the ellipses of the Patrick Stewart impression. But everyone began to pass dishes and serve themselves food. Everyone except Debbie, who bowed her head and began to mumble silently to herself in prayer. We all froze for an awkward beat, then bowed our heads in solidarity until she finished. So I was just imagining like them sort of being like the ghost type of reaction as she's you know, saying the common prayer people do before dinner, but just people are like holding the dish of mashed potatoes that they're passing, like frozen as someone's about to grab it because they're so freaked out by the idea of someone saying grace.
Yeah. Cut to one person with the, you know, fork full of peas up to their face, their eyes wide, and a couple peas like dribble off their fork. Oh God.
It's so, so incredibly foreign. But those beats are all, this is something I mentioned last time. He had looked over at his dad during that mood swing, but during the course of this dinner, he looks at his father. He glances over at his father. He sits bolt upright, then glances at his father. Then he glances at his father again, but he was studying my face. So a hell of a lot of glancing is going on during this dinner. And I'm just imagining at some point in time, his dad just being like, would you stop shooting me glances out of the corner of your eye?
Stop glancing at me. It's unsettling. This was a mood swing that I noted. Speaking of that, unfortunately, I think this is Shin, right? Unfortunately, my parents both passed away years ago, about halfway through my tour of duty up here. So I never got to say goodbye to them, which was extremely painful at the time. Then his expression brightened and he reached over and gave my father's shoulder a squeeze before slapping him on the back.
Yeah.
Holy cow, dude. Yeah. Give it a second.
Yeah, literal back slapping, like that cliche of like the cigar chomping people doing that in a meeting is provoked by the memory of his parents dying, the extremely painful death.
That would have been better in Saving Private Ryan when Giovanni Ribisi was talking about how his mother would come home and he would pretend to be asleep and, you know, the tears are welling up in his eyes as the fire crackles in the middle of the blown out church. If he had suddenly just stood up and go, and then slap Tom Hanks back.
Well, let's go get anyway. That guy. What do you say, Tommy? But yeah, then pretty much after that, because I noted that too, but he says, but my friend Xavier here had already gone through the same thing and he helped me get through it. He lost his folks too. A few, Shin cut himself off, then shot a nervous glance over at me and my father, who was once again staring intently at the tablecloth. So the roller coaster has just gone back up that hill and then back right down again.
Good Lord.
Someone asked, but no, maybe I just looked it up. But glance has a 76 occurrences in this, not in this chapter, in the book as a total, but still that seemed like a lot.
That is impressive.
This was one that I like just in terms of a sort of inscrutable, what the hell are we supposed to be visualizing here? How are you doing, Zach? He asked. You holding up okay? I nodded. Then I shook my head. Then I shrugged and shook my head again. And the immediate thing that conjured up for me, this is a good to make a reference and to make one that not a single one of our listeners is going to understand. But what I imagined was when hot dog guy in The Happening turns around in the greenhouse and says to Zooey Deschanel, you like hot dogs, don't you?
Yes.
And she sort of nods, laughs, shakes her head, and then mouths the word no. And he like gives her the okay and turns back around. So we'll post that clip. But that is, I don't know. I think that's a pretty spot on reaction for what he's doing. It's a very confusing mixed signal from someone who's clearly uncomfortable.
I also, maybe the guy and a partner in Samurai Cop who does the strange faces off.
Yeah.
That would be my reaction to him, you know, like as you're trying to follow what he's doing, like, whoa, surprise? No, wait, yeah. What am I supposed to be?
And sort of like pursing your lips together in the letter O and like wide eyes.
Exactly. All right. Here's one that caught me up. Your father has also been awarded, speaking of the embarrassment thing again, your father has also been awarded the Medal of Honor three times by three different presidents. So again, this guy is like, you know, to pull an old reference, Audie Murphy won like 6 Congressional Medals of Honors. This guy is a piece of steel. This guy is a, you know, iron will. And Shin said, "Bet you didn't know that, did you?" He shook his head at my father. He's too modest to even tell his own son. He thought his father had died in a sewage treatment plant explosion. He's only known about his existence for, as we've parsed out, like 30 to 60 minutes.
Right, like, exactly.
Son, look, I bought you a bunch of Lucky Charms. That's the most important thing. Is anybody hungry? Oh, by the way, I won 3 Congressional Medals of Honor by 3 different presidents. I don't want you to get lost in all this shuffle of the eating cereal dry with no milk.
Right. Yeah. I would. And, you know, when I would go over to my grandfather's house to watch the Redskins game, like I wouldn't be able to get in the door before he would be like, "By the way, Connor, when I liberated Dachau, this is some of the memorabilia I retrieved." Like, it's like, what the hell is he? It took until I was probably like doing a project in high school before that was even mentioned to me. And I was interviewing him for the project. Like,
right.
Veterans who have received the Medal of Honor don't necessarily go flouting him like you would a.
They're known for their effusiveness over their own accomplishments.
But yeah, his father's embarrassment. I thought this was fun. This is probably in reaction to that. My father nodded, closing his eyes to his embarrassment, the same way I did when I received compliments. And so, one, we get it. You know, you're probably a clone of your father. And then two, so he's aware of this sort of involuntary behavior, which to me was like, there's nobody on earth is sort of aware of these annoying little quirks they have because they're reflexes. I noted that like when I was on Jeopardy, I was like, oh, that's like every time I was doing something, like my hand went up to sort of touch the side of my face, like as I was like pondering something, and it was a nervous tick. Yeah. And I clearly was not aware of it until I saw it on TV. But he's aware that he closes his eyes when he received compliments. It's not true.
No, this idiot who
interacts with like 3 humans is not aware that that's something he does, especially since he's also not in control of his emotions. He routinely blacks out from rage.
Yeah. And he's swinging between enormous emotions, too. He and his father. So to be aware of such a subtle tick like that is just not. I got a beef with this sentence, and then we can continue with, oh man, I guess I have more notes for this chapter.
Yeah.
Here's a sentence that needed, this is just an editing thing. When Wodey finished eating a moment later, she got up from the table and went over to the observation window, then spent a moment staring down at the enormous radio dish nestled inside the enormous crater far below.
Wow.
Just come on, just cross the word, just say like, you know, need a different adjective, need a different adjective, different, right. Cut, do, you know, anyway.
Right.
That was just such a clunky wonder.
Had ran out of perpetual motion. It would just, he needed to restart it again to hit the enter key. The idea that he's sitting here, like the generals are talking to him about it, and that he was still concerned, like at this point in time, he's concerned about like the minor celebrities that they've met. So they're discussing the impending attack, and then he interrupts. "I've been wondering about that," I said, interrupting. "And how did they get Carl Sagan to keep the year opens a secret for so long?" Which at this point in time, I was like, who gives a shit about Carl Sagan? You know, this guy's been, he's been dead for 20 years. It's like, you know, bringing up the time that you met a minor celebrity as you're, you know, about to give a eulogy at someone's funeral. It's like, this is not important at this point in time. I know you thought he was cool, but like the game has changed.
Yeah, we're again under threat of imminent attack. Why are you talking about a pop scientist who died 20 years ago? But that leads to what I thought was a shocking scandal when he revealed this information. He says he only agreed, this is about Carl Sagan, he only agreed to remain silent on the condition that the EDA give him the funding necessary to educate the world's population and try to prepare them for the news that humanity is not alone. That was how he got the funding for his Cosmos television series. So this is a scandal. So PBS got the show for free? Yeah. Or did Sagan kind of double deal? Did he pocket the money from PBS? I don't know. It smells rotten to me. If he was getting millions from the EDA, I mean, basically unlimited money, right? And then they said, go create a TV series that talks nothing about aliens invading.
It might have redeemed the whole book if he just kept interrupting to sort of grill him on that topic throughout the rest of the thing, if it became just an examination of this Carl Sagan's fraud and tax evasion.
Right. Like, there's a lot of compliance at PBS. Did that, is the budget available? It's probably available online. Could we go look at that right now? Yeah. Let me grab some Lucky Charms boxes and we'll drill down on this.
Yeah. They ran pledge drives for that series too. So, like, were people calling in thinking this was supporting great programming like this and other programming on PBS? Because that's, you know, that's a lot of tote bags given away under dishonest means.
Yeah. In fact, I've got my tote bag right here. this tote bag is dead to me.
I pulled out my copy of Kaboom on Atari from my Carl Sagan branded Cosmos tote bag, and my dad nodded his silent approval.
The general yes, nodded his silent approval.
If it was in the cards, there'd be Kabooms later aplenty, but they wouldn't be us. They would be the Europans who are attacking in 30 minutes.
Stop improving the book. All right. Here was another sentence I got a beef with. Everyone had given up on correcting Milo every time he referred to the Europans as Europeans. Even poor Graham, who actually was European. Yes, everyone had given up, even Graham, despite the fact that this was the first time he'd done it in his presence. So everyone gave up on him. I thought that was really unfair to the Kush master. Like, come on, you know, let's be a little more supportive of him. This is the first time you've heard it. Right. And again, it is confusing. When you read it, it does, your mind goes to Europeans immediately. So
yes, exactly. People mispronounce my name wrong all the time. It's like, you know, I understand that it's a confusing word to look at and then translate into spoken language.
I mispronounced your name, I think 7 years after knowing you on camera once. It's just like it came up on a card and I just did it, you know, like reading it out loud. So I get it. But they couldn't even give Kushmaster a break after one mispronunciation of it.
So there's a good moment when Graham notices that Shin, after he's sort of laying out, they start laying out these sort of conspiracy theories that are obviously going to have some bearing on the plot. And just like the throwing the football thing into the dodecahedron, I found them pretty hard to follow. I found them hard to track even the second time I read it through. But Graham lays out his theory that, like, this is all too easy type of thing. But he notices that Shin was now making a screw loose gesture with his index finger and flipped him the bird as he kept talking.
Yeah.
He's doing the cuckoo, cuckoo.
I found that hard to. I had to reread that a couple times because it's like, is he doing both? Like, oh, it's just a clumsy sentence. Shin was making the screw loose gesture, right. And
Graham
then
gives him
Graham flipped him the bird as he kept talking. Major Graham Fogg,
yes.
Protector of Earth, one of the three people keeping all of us from annihilation.
So this was another good thing. This happens twice in the next couple pages, but Shin is saying the Overlord is made up. The Overlord is like the boss, I guess. He was invented by Chaos Terrain to give the enemy a face, a villainous, slightly humanoid alien that humanity could rally against, like Ming the Merciless or Darth Vader or Zod or – I get the idea, Debbie said. Like, yeah. I think Debbie is standing in as a proxy for the audience at this point in time,
yeah,
like cutting off the listing of villains.
Finally. Yeah, exactly. This is a weird thing. So again, we know the scene. This is the three guys protecting Earth. Graham is going off on his theory of what's actually happening, and Shin, and these guys are the three musketeers. They talk about it when they first get there. Like, we've been here forever. We keep it together. This is how we do it. We are strong and solid and we're protecting Earth. And then Graham immediately starts off on what Shin thinks is, you know, like people never landed on the moon, like the worst Alex Jones conspiracy theory ever. And here's Graham. You can't stop the signal, pal, Graham said. I've also heard from several reliable sources that one of their scout ships crashed in Florida in the late 80s, only it wasn't a drone. And I thought to myself, wait, why does he have to hear stuff? Like, they're the top level people, right? They're getting all information is being given to them. Either that or it's the weirdest conspiracy in the world, which I guess that's obviously what it's going to be. But it's just so strange that a general just doesn't go like, look, just give me all the information. I have a top secret clearance.
Right.
But I heard, I heard from a guy down in Florida that you killed a man once. Like, it's weird. What are you talking about?
It's like they're the guy who was stuck in that pit on Lost who had to, like, just press the button every now and then or else something would happen, but no one told him what it was. But these guys are up there. They have fought the battles. And so, yeah, they evidently believe that there's some level of mistrust people higher up than them are keeping, which, you know, I assume is going to implicate the one-eyed general at some point in time. But
right. Yeah. But if this is happening, then you just go like, hey, bring me off the moon base. You know, obviously right. There are many. The entire Earth is behind this effort. So just I'm out of here because I no longer believe it, you know.
Right. Well, they can't do that because later it says when he's reading his dad's emails that like he can't come home because if anyone learned he was still alive, especially his family, it could jeopardize everything he had worked for and sacrificed for all these years. And I was just like, why? What? I don't understand what,
yeah.
You know
it's like, out in the open now. The attack is underway. Everyone knows about it, right?
Right. Well, that was like something he said during the course of the thing. But it was like if he had showed up after 5 years, like I wasn't dead. I mean, I don't know. It doesn't seem like that would be the sort of thing that could jeopardize this entire thing. It seems like he'd be dismissed as a lunatic and would not be able to get his story printed. But like even if you knew, you know, what the point of this was, like, again, the secrecy of this mission is a thing imposed by the author to allow for Hollywood to prepare everybody in the meantime. The actual need to keep it secrecy seems very dubious from the point of view of a casual reader.
Oh, yeah. That does not hold together at all.
So, yeah, he heads out of this thing, like storms away, like Shin storms out and then our hero storms out. Again, the composure of the hardened battle hero. But he goes to read the father's emails in his dorm room and starts doing that. The thing that struck me very funny, his father is reading like 9 days after he faked his death and left. He's writing to his 1-year-old son. He's like, you see, I didn't really die in an explosion at the plant, which reminded me of Paul McCartney on the Chris Farley show when Chris Farley asked him if it was a hoax that he had faked his death on Abbey Road. And Paul McCartney sort of indulges in like, yeah, I wasn't really dead. It's like, well, yes, you've sent us the email. That's going to be assumed. But he goes on to then say, like, I didn't want you to spend the rest of your life believing your dad was just some loser sewage worker, which is like, what the hell did the sewage industry ever do to Ernest Cline? Like, they provide a valuable service.
Yeah, that was a weird drive-by.
Yeah, it's not the most, you know, pleasant work, I'm sure, but we need them to function. And his dad had dropped out of high school or whatever and just been a gamer his whole life. So he had no designs on any sort of career or higher ambition. So like,
I take personal insult. I think I mentioned before, my father did that. He was a water treatment. He was certified to do that, which he was a dropout. He grew up, his parents ran away. He was raised by his aunts. I don't want to get too personal. He was a hard scrabble dude. He went into the Marines and then he ended up getting a degree in water treatment, which is, you know, just like a correspondence thing or something, but he wanted to raise himself up to be able to do this job. And I used to follow him around and it's fairly technical stuff. I mean, you're dealing with drinking water and sewage treatment. This is, I felt like, hey, dude, come on.
Sure. It's not like his dad was going down there and like secretly like eating sewage, like as his deep shame or something like that. Or like, you know, it wasn't he wasn't a guy who like, I don't know, even if he was a guy that picks up and cleans porta potties, you need those anyway.
right. But this whole mechanism of him going in and then reading the letters that we have to read, I felt like, could that have not been a sentence? Like, then I sat and I read everything that my father had written, or, you know, by page 16, I was a puddle of tears and I understood the whole thing. No, he goes into the letters. Like, we know what these are. These have all been explained. He talked about how he wrote them. He did all this thing. And no letter was different from exactly how you imagined it in your mind, correct? Yep. I mean, there's no difference. So suddenly to have to read them, I was just like, this is not going to happen. I am going to skip over these.
If you're just listening to us, yeah, they did ran for probably 3 pages of book of just letters, and they were, like Mike said, exactly what you would expect. I miss you. I feel bad. I hope you can forgive me. You know, letter from absentee dad, bingo.
Yeah. But this, so I did read them. As I said, I wanted not to read them, but I am comprehensive. One letter said he'd gone a little nuts for a while. He wrote about how they put him on antidepressants. When things got really bad, he took tranquilizers sometimes too. And he was required to video conference with a shrink back on Earth twice a week.
Yeah.
General, please take your meds, sir. No baseball game until you start behaving. Like, this is suddenly like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yes.
With the guy who's the hardened piece of iron general who has defended Earth. It's just a weird little detail that I think he doesn't understand. Like, wait a minute. I don't think that would happen.
Right. Yeah. They would retract anyone from the front lines once they started to show these signals of mental disorder, you know. But
space madness, as Ren and Stimpy, the
fans. Yes. But I think that they were the fact that they do delve into these serious psychological issues, I mean, serious, like, okay. But then the fact that they're like balancing that out, they're like, hey, we play D&D 5 nights a week. Yes. We play You Really Got Me by Van Halen with our shitty 3-piece band. Like, it does sort of, you know, go against the, anytime you introduce any sort of actual pathos or negativity in these books, it cancels out so fervently the crappy pop culture stuff.
Yeah, you can't keep, that's a juggling act that even a very, very talented writer couldn't handle. Like, somehow they're jamming on Van Halen and we're you know, wiping a little bit of a tear from our eyes. We understand that he has these severe mental disabilities. Yeah.
They finish Right Now, and then Sheehan is like, let's do Panama. And he's like, 1 second. And then he pops his 2 tranquilizers, washes it down with Diet Mountain Dew. And then it's like, all right, let's launch into it.
Oh, man, what a weird world.
But yeah, this, so he reads all those emails. He's getting, you know, sort of teared up. It's like watching Matthew McConaughey's videos in Interstellar. But then he goes into the goes to go track down his father because something doesn't seem right this entire time, and he walks in on his father practicing the mission with Shin and Milo. And I thought it was pretty funny that his father is still using his trademark Red Jai's catchphrase of "You're welcome."
Yep.
Even in practice, and you know, we've understand that he's using it when he's shooting down European aliens who clearly probably don't have any concept of what "You're welcome" means. But he's sort of robotically reciting it here, and I thought that was a fun detail.
Those are the tranks are talking there, let's be
right,
honest.
Exactly. You're welcome. You're welcome.
This is my final note in, what was that, chapter 17. Mm-hmm. I think he looked at a film of his father.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And as he sat there in the dark, rambling into his QCOM's video camera, he looked and sounded just like a raving, straitjacketed asylum patient. More specifically, a lot like Brad Pitt in 12 Monkeys.
Yep, that was the standout for me.
He couldn't just leave it. He had to do it. Like, what are you picturing when you picture a straitjacketed, raving asylum patient? Not good enough. You're going to need to picture the exact same one I'm picturing, which is from a movie.
Which is not even, you know, I don't understand what that means. I saw that a while ago, but that doesn't seem to me like one that's, you know, permeated our pop culture. To, you know, people aren't putting posters of that on their dorm rooms or, you know, photoshopping memes onto that picture. Like, it's not a good reference.
No, not at all. Not at all.
But yeah, so that chapter ends, and then he sort of recruits his father, and his father walks him down a lot of halls, sort of in silence, to his another space in this space that it's hard for me to envision the layout. I know there's golf balls perched on top of shot glasses somewhere.
His father says, let's go to a private place, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then then there's more physical description, which, you know, to be honest, this is the physical description, you know, of going through tunnels and taking a left at the thing with the lights embedded in the walls. It's that moment in, I used to read Lord of the Rings when I was young. I would read it once every year, maybe every 2 years, just reread it on Christmas vacation. It was a little thing that soothed me. But I would skip any physical description of, you know, the landscape flattened out. There was a short bowl beneath them, but to their left were trees. It's like, I'm lost. I don't know what you're talking about. Right. And that's kind of what I do with this. I just zone out and go, okay, I can skip this page. All right, no.
Yeah.
But again, I do read it all for you, the listener.
Scan until you see the word rig or grin or
glance.
The name of a 80s TV show. Yeah, exactly. But then, so he goes back to the familiar tropes in order to convey what he's describing, which I thought this was really, really great. It looked like the lair of a homicide detective on some TV show. So it looked like the lair. Two sentences later, his dad says, "I know how all this stuff must look," he said, as if he'd read my mind. "Like Russell Crowe's garage in A Beautiful Mind, right?" And Zach says, "I was thinking it looked more like a supervillain's lair." It's like, which lair is it? You've described it to us as two different layers within the span of three sentences. And to use one on their own is a lazy analogy. And then to use two back to back.
Yeah.
Well, three, really. Cause, you know, that's the same. I'm the string wall is what he's imagining, that cliche.
Of course. That's why I had the alternate sentence. I rewrote this for him.
Okay.
The conspiracy theories I saw tacked to the wall looked like the ones Mel Gibson had tacked to his apartment wall in Conspiracy Theory. That would have been more. I felt like that was more Kleinian. Why A Beautiful Mind?
Yeah, that would have been perfect. And that would have been used unironically, even though it's clearly a hilarious sentence.
I do like that his father, when he his father makes a reference and then he says, "Yeah, like we better watch out," or something, blah, 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 cigarette smoking man, right? And his father ignores it. And I made a note like, I'm starting to warm to this guy. Yes, a little bit. This is not bad.
Yeah, another audience proxy, perhaps, just like starting to shrug those off. But yeah, so he goes into his sort of insane conspiracy theory, which I'm sure is going to be proven at least partially true. And again, it was hard to track for me just because it's like, yeah, so the aliens do exist, but they're like giving us a chance in order to prove that humans are able to fulfill the ideals that we set up in these movies that we've been making, you know, the self-sacrifice of people that are usually depicted in movies. And the way that his dad has come up with this theory is that every now and then, ever since we first made contact with them 42 years ago, which is a Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy reference. Yeah, exactly. The aliens have been intercepting our movies and television broadcasts. Then they edit clips from them together and transmit them back to us. So I was just sort of delighted to imagine the the aliens crouched over their avid bays editing the clips. Like, you know, no, give it a little bit more Independence Day. And cut the scene from Day of the Earth Stood Still by like 15 frames. Really tighten it up.
Run it back. Yeah, okay. And that looks good. Yeah, now mash them together.
Right, yeah.
Smoking a cigarette behind the guy at the bay.
This is going to take 20 minutes to render. Let's grab a drink.
Yeah, where are you eating today? You know, jingling the change in his pocket on his left.
But then he starts to spot brief scenes taken from dozens of science fiction films, all of them featuring hostile alien invaders of some kind. In the space of just a few seconds, I spotted shots from various films in the Trek and Wars franchise.
Yeah, my note after that was tough to keep reading after that.
And as we've pointed out before, like neither of those films franchises take place on Earth, and so neither of them really have the alien invaders that they're that makes this whole thing hinges on, you know, Star Wars.
Yeah, it just the dots don't connect the way that he wants, and it's really wedging it into a matrix that can't handle it. You know,
it's wedged the hell into there because Star Wars fights evil humanoids.
I would like you to. This would be a good drinking game, I guess. Whatever, you can do whatever with it. Video games or video in the space of a few sentences by the hardened general. You ready? This is General. Mm-hmm. General Lightpants, or whatever his name is. I always dreamed of making video games for a living when I grew up, so you can imagine how I felt when I got the chance to help design the video games that might help save the world. Arbogast and I collaborated for several months, not in person, but we video conferenced several times a week. It was his job to create the video games that would train the world's populations to fight off the Europas. I would just stop my dad and go, Dad, You're saying video over it. What's wrong with you?
Yeah, a fugue state has been lapsed into.
Yes.
What if he pronounced all of them like that guy on a SCTV?
Video.
Yeah, and so his father's conclusion is that the Europans are sort of setting them up to fail with all these repeated invasions. But he says, Another Star Wars thing that he's gotten wrong here is it was a trap and we walked right into it, just like Admiral fucking Ackbar. Like, and so that's, you know, it's a very famous Star Wars scene, but Admiral Ackbar is seated on a spaceship, you know, wheeling around in his chair to say it's a trap. Like, it's just a very bad mixed metaphor of that process.
Yeah, that is the famous thing about him is that he identifies traps.
Yes.
So that's I thought that was another Godzilla moment, like Godzilla. Yeah, yeah. You know, it's just okay. We get it. We know what you're doing. Yeah,
exactly. The other, this was another audience proxy. He's talking about 2001, the alien set up monolith for us to discover.
Right.
And his dad is going on about that. And then Zach says, I nodded, not in agreement, but just to indicate I understood the reference. That, you know, Ernest Klein, ladies and gentlemen, that is, if you have a reaction to his book other than that, I commend you, because that's pretty much what he's going for here.
Yeah.
And I see lots of people to sort of make that joke about watching the movie is going to be like, just nodding and nudging people next to you when you get references.
Yeah. And then later he says along those lines, I forget what the joke is, but I just have his reaction to it. Under other circumstances, this might have made me laugh, and then hard stop, period, but not then. And I just, why? He's been laughing the whole damn time. He laughed when Shin said, set course for romance, for God's sake. Suddenly he's getting stingy with the laughs. Yeah.
No kidding. A grin started to force its way onto my face, but I did the thing where I put my hand down from the top of my forehead and wipe it off, and I'm frowning when my hand passes up from my mouth. Oh, he says that aliens are always showing up to put humanity on trial. The day the Earth stood still, stranger in a strange land, have spacesuit, will travel, and a bunch of different Star Trek episodes. The reopens might have made a million different motives. One of the 80s reboot on the 80s reboot of The Twilight Zone, there was this one episode called A Small Talent for War. I raised my hand to cut him off. Again, someone standing in for the audience by this point in time.
I said, wait, someone stopped listing a bunch of pop culture crap. Like, how dare you? He does that? Like,
right.
You have not earned this. They mentioned the tune from Close Encounters. The ba-ba-ba-ba-ba, right? So, that thing where a cat's meow in Japanese, you know, they printed out a cat says, Nyan.
Okay, yeah.
A pig goes honk in Albanian. I think there's I think the Mexican cock crow is famous. I don't remember what that is, but I think
we had a page in our Spanish textbook that was detailing all of this.
Kukika or something like that. You know? But his version of the da 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 is la lu la ba ba. Which I just thought was, would not have, I don't hear it that way. I guess, you know, look, again, there's a lot of variation allowed, but
la, I had no idea
lu, la, ba, ba does not convey the, I mean, you can picture the tune in your head, but would you go to la, la, la?
I don't remember it.
To me, they're all ba, 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 ba. They're all ba's to me, but he's la, lu, la, ba, ba.
Right. So. That's like the NBC chimes, like. Dun, dun, dun. You wouldn't introduce different syllables. You just say them in the different notes.
Yeah. But anyway, that's how Klein hears them.
Right. He's trying to set up some more conspiracy things. I don't know what he's getting at. But, you know, does any of this feel like something that could happen to real life to you? Or does the events seem to be unfolding in a way they would in a story or a movie? It's like, okay, by this point in time,
it's a Mobius strip of self-awareness at this point.
Yeah, I realized I was responding to someone's email last night, and I said that we are 250 pages in. There's 100 pages left, like, for whatever is going to happen here to unfold. Like, we're near the end of this book, and nothing has happened. But the other thing that I thought was pretty fun was he's talking about Archibald Vance, high patch guy, Run DMC unappreciator.
Mm-hmm.
He says, Archie is a good man. Fearless, honorable, but the guy doesn't have much of an imagination. And he doesn't know shit about common tropes in science fiction, which is like, it's a deep gasp, because that's the ultimate sin in the Kleinverse.
Yeah, he goes on, take his call sign, Viper. He borrowed that from Tom Skerritt's character in Top Gun, his all-time favorite movie. He hates science fiction. I could never get him to watch Trek, Wars, Firefly, or BSG.
Oh, my God.
Exclamation point. He shook his head. The bastard even refused to watch E.T. Who doesn't love E.T., I ask you? Again, the hardened general is sitting around trying to get the hardened admiral to watch Trek, Wars, Firefly, and BSG.
Yeah, he gave all of those a shot, though. Like, he sat there with him as, like, you know, General Lightman was sitting there, like, doing the nudge and then, like, pointing as a good line was about to happen. And Archibald Bald Vance is like, it's not working for me. Please stop. He's like, no, okay, well, Firefly, this will be what wins you over.
Fumbling with the remote. Like, I'll just fast forward past this part where the, you know, the Peter Coyote comes in and they put E.T. in a thing. Anyway, he's going to die. Look, the flowers. Come on, Vance. Nothing.
He's walking over to his desk with Finnegan from Star Trek on his phone and then just hovering over his shoulder as he sort of makes him watch it.
I am on a phone call here, sir. Exactly. I'm on the red phone to the president.
Oh.
Man, oh man. But that I felt was like, that is probably Klein humor. Putting it, he puts any humor can go into the mouth of any character, which doesn't make any sense. You know what I mean? Like, it's not, if it was tossed off and like the guy doesn't even like E.T., I elbowed, you know, so-and-so and then he got shot in the chest. No, you know, but this, like, spends a paragraph of his dad doing like a really, really lame joke, which could have been in the mouth of any character. You know what I mean? Right. Like then it just is like, stop wasting our time with this. Put it in somebody else's mouth where it makes sense. But whatever it is, it's not a joke in any
way. Right. Just the way that, the way that one of his beloved 80s movies would work is that usually you're going to have the sidekick who probably knows all this shit and is going around making these jokes and these references. But when it's in the mouth of every single character, no matter their lot in life, how many of their loved ones have recently died, how many years they've been isolated on the moon taking tranquilizers, it just rings so hollow and fake.
Yeah, there's no, so he gets up to the moon base. There's no cigar chewing guy who's like, these freaks play D&D every night. Right. It's not something I'm ever going to touch because, you know what? You know, clicks his rifle and just, they don't give a shit about, you know.
Right.
Nope. Everybody just is the same person.
The same paper thin shitty person.
Yes.
Yeah. But that ends with his dad saying, hey, like, I recognize this stuff because I'm a gamer, Zach, like you. Which is, I guess, that's his version of do you want to have a catch dead from Field of Dreams type of thing.
Now let's get that box of Lucky Charms with no milk.
Eat it dry.
Yes.
Which is, you know, as they've gone down to this room, clearly Milo has picked the marshmallows out of every one of those half dozen boxes.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. And then doesn't remember doing it.
Milo. All right. I think that takes us through the end of chapter 18 and, you know, sets up the climax of all this stuff they're alluding to for the final 100 pages.
Yes, indeed. So we got through it. Thank you, everyone, for wow. That was a long slog, but it was worth it.
Yeah, it was. But I think it's time to examine some really dumb and bad, boring sentences.
A sentence begins with a capital letter. A capital letter is a letter that's big. A capital letter is not a small letter. A capital letter is big, big, big. A sentence ends with a period.
I can't wait to play that song live.
Yeah, no kidding. Oh, yeah, we should have a
Sisyphus Brewing. Can we get a band in to do it, to cover?
Maybe Kevin will play a nose flute, yeah.
Maybe
Paul Westerberg will drop by.
Yeah, that could be. Or maybe if we get the cover band that plays on the Moonbase Alpha One Thunderdome. Shred on that.
Pick up a bass guitar every now and then. Yeah, just a tease. So come on out and see if that actually happens. But we're going to record the whole thing, obviously, so you can listen to it once it's done.
Yeah, but you know you want to see it live.
I mean, yeah, come see it live. I mean,
then we can meet you and pull a Pendergast together.
And listen, I'm saying this right now. You come to the live show, you're wearing the cow rig shirt.
Oh, God.
I'm buying your first beer. That's a promise.
There you have it. I believe that is legally binding.
There's a flash mob of cow rig shirt peoples there that could I could really put a hurting on this. But
2 years later, I find you living in a refrigerator box on near the Grain Belt sign in Minneapolis. Connor, man, you went all in on that.
First 10 cow rig shirts only.
Okay.
But so the dumb sense of the week for me, the first time this has happened, I think mine got burnt. Mine was he looked a lot like Brad Pitt in 12 Monkeys because I thought that was just unnecessary. And then once you added the reference, it added nothing for me because it wasn't a very common reference.
Wow, I burnt that for you. Sorry. And this was mine. Both of ours were burnt by things that set course. Ellipses for romance, Shin okay. quoted, doing such a perfect Patrick Stewart that Milo and I both laughed out loud. Which I like the detail that if he hadn't done such a perfect Patrick Stewart, that would have been mm-hmm. like, would you shut up and sit down?
Right.
But it was pretty perfect, so I gotta laugh.
But we had a few other people write in with them. Thanks to everyone who writes in. This is really fun to read, and if I don't write back, apologies for that, but people submit great stuff. This was, again, his father regarding his father, Andrew wrote in this one. They were classified medals of honor, my father said. It's not like anyone will ever find out about them. And Andrew added, for one thing, a classified medal of honor is still a medal of honor. And secondly, someone just found out about them, probably because one of the few people his father would want to know, which is, of course, the next sentence. The classified modifier makes it sound extra childish. that's very stupid. Wesley wrote in. This is before the thing we talked about with Milo earlier. Milo nodded imperceptibly, caught in the throes of some sort of gamer fanboy aneurysm. And just the imperceptible nod that I'm pointing out and acknowledging. Yeah. Trevor wrote in, my father made another gesture at the screen and the animation of our solar system began to speed up, making the planets zoom around the sun like a pack of race cars, each on a separate track. And he said, this makes no sense. I have never seen race cars racing around separate tracks. And the fact that they're not separate makes them not in a pack.
Man, you know, it's so dense with that stuff that you forget. This is why this is fun.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and that was, I think, the last chapter. So we always speed up towards the end because the first ones get front loaded. And then this was another good one. Elizabeth said, wrote in, you're a Lucky Charms man, right? Dry with no milk. We laid in a few dozen boxes for you, see? He pointed over at one of the unoccupied pods across the room where half a dozen boxes of my favorite breakfast cereal sat stacked like crates of ammunition.
Oh, man.
He said, how many boxes were there? Are there 36 or are there 6?
This editor has – this would be great. I mean, we got to get this guy on trial and talk about this. Let's – please, if anyone has any connection – I know it's a very, very long shot. We both publish books. I no longer really know anyone. There's a lot of churn and burn in the industry. I probably know no one who could get us to him.
Right.
But maybe. I'll give it a shot and we'll see. Yeah. But if anyone
if the guy who positively reviewed Ready Player One for the AV Club was too embarrassed to even respond to my email, I'm guessing that the guy who edited the reviled book Armada may have already tossed a rope over a beam, but
I don't know. Maybe he'll come in like, singing like a bird, like, all right, let's go through every,
Right. Exactly. The NDA ran out to this day 3 years ago. And
he will slam a huge tome on the counter and just start going, you want to get into this? Page one, baby.
Right. They had those leaked editor's notes for that guy Milo's book, which were very funny. His father being like, delete this entire chapter. And you would wonder if it was just things that he said like that and ignored. But on to the boring sentence of the week. We had another nominee from Elizabeth. I glanced at the shoulder of his uniform. This is talking about Graham. I glanced at the shoulder of his uniform and saw the Union Jack there instead of the U.S. flag. I also noticed that the word defense on his EDA insignia was spelled with a C instead of an S. Those are great, great details to indicate that the guy who has the British accent and is British was in fact British, not pulling a Pendergast on us. My boring sentence of the week. This is something I just noticed because it was all one sentence and it was very boring. My father tapped a button on his QCOM and the bright blue dome over our head switched on like the screen of a high definition television, providing a 360-degree view of the cratered landscape surrounding the moon base that made it seem as if we were standing in the observation deck on the base's top level instead of in a reinforced bunker far beneath the lunar surface.
Oh, my God.
So, I mean, it is one sentence. And if you haven't, you know, fallen asleep by high definition television, there's probably like 50 more words in that sentence after that.
The editor storms in. Now, look, I will read you the original sentence.
Right, exactly.
I improved it 30% and then Stet was written all over it. my boring sentence of the week, because I, again, was burnt on the dumb sentence. Are we to that point? Should I read my boring sentence of the week?
Yeah. That's. I mean, there might have been other people sent them in, but I didn't copy them over.
Okay, this is again is one sentence. So you just have to picture you're trying to read, and you get to this. You're trying to follow everything. You're picturing it. Your mind's eye is going over time. Each pit contained a simulated ADI-88 interceptor cockpit, a pilot seat, flight stick, and all of its familiar control panels and system indicators arrayed beneath a wraparound display canopy that slid into place over you when you climbed into the pilot seat. Got it?
Yeah. You know what? I'll rewrite that one. It's a hell of a rig. That's yes. Efficient. Conjures up the exact same thing in my mind's eye.
Oh, man. Why does he even attempt to do it? I don't understand why he has to get this out. I mean, it's inconceivable that he thinks it's interesting to any other human being. So it must be something he's compelled internally to. I will do this. My mm-hmm. will overwhelms all editors and every obstacle that stands in my way. And I will have a 75-word sentence that contains an incomprehensible description of a rig.
Right. That probably resembles, again, the one from Prometheus or something like that. What he's getting at. Well, I think that wraps us up for this week. For next time, let's read up to 293. That's where phase three begins. Remember, this book is in three phases. The phase three is hopefully the one where something happens.
It's going to be interesting when we start to talk about, and again, we'll probably, you know, we're going to be doing the movie live, but other mm-hmm. things will creep into it. But I'm just worried about the crowd. If the people who are phase one fans start to get into rumbles with the phase three fans, or the phase two fans start to get a little rowdy. So
yeah, exactly.
We may have some crowd control there on, you know, the phasers, do we call them?
Yeah, I think so. We're going to divide it by phaser, like a wedding with bride or the groom when you come in for seating.
Yes.
But yeah, the phase three starts with a quote from H.G. Wells. I think this one was Sun Tzu, and I don't remember who phase one was. Eugene Jacobs, the creator of Defender, was the creator of phase one. So we're doing that, I guess.
Yep. We're what is it? Stealing valor, really, you know, stealing a gravitas and import every time he starts a phase.
Yeah. So yeah, it's phase three. Read to that next time, and keep the emails coming, keep the fan fiction coming. And we hope to see you in Minneapolis.
Yeah, that should be really fun. You know, a lot of times people say fakely, like, you know, get your tickets, it could sell out. I honestly have no idea, but it's a pretty small theater. So I mm-hmm. would advise, if you were going to make any, not that anyone would travel, I hope you do, but if you do travel at all to get here in Minneapolis, it is a small theater. So do get your tickets early. I'm not being coy about that. It's there's not a ton of them. You know, who knows how many people will be interested in this bizarre little thing. But, you know, if you have any interest at all to hang out with us while we do Ready Player One, the movie review, do it quickly.
Yeah, because there's a lot of buzz about the movie. The internet is filled with people mocking it in new ways every day, and it's very exciting to be a part of it. So thanks to everyone who recommends people check out the podcast. It's gained a surge of interest in the past couple of weeks as the movie approaches, and I don't see that dying down. So thank you.
My final word to you all is la, 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 ba, ba, ladies and gentlemen. This is 372 pages. We'll never get back. Connor, any parting words?
Look forward to seeing all you beautiful people in cow shirts. That's my parting words.
Connor's pushing them hard. Sales on it. We won't even do a sales update. We just expect you to buy one. We'll see you in Minneapolis on March 11th.
April 11th.
April. I'm
not,
terrible.
Not tomorrow. Yeah.
Do not come in March. April 11th at Sisyphus Brewing. Check it out. And we'll be sending all of our Facebook and everything. And we'll see you next time on 372P.